Our ancestors traveled through salt and stars, and so do contemporary Pacific Islander communities today. In this podcast, we consider how to build good relations with the communities we come from in Oceania, the communities we live with here in the Salt Lake City area, and especially the Indigenous communities whose lands we live on.
As Pacific Islander people who live in Utah, we are nourished by the lands of the Ute, Goshute, Shoshone, and Paiute peoples. We are far from the ocean, but close to the salt water of the Great Salt Lake. We are far from the night sky over our home islands, but can look up and see the same stars.
Join us as we explore and build relations of salt and stars.
Relations of Salt and Stars is a new podcast produced by the Pacific Island Studies Program at the University of Utah and hosted by faculty members Dr. Angela L. Robinson, who's Chukis, and myself, Dr. Miley Arvin, and I'm Kanaka Maoli, or Native Hawaiian. With the name Relations of Salt and Stars, we invoke the ties historically forged between the Pacific Islands and Utah, as well as the ones still in formation.
Kastalelia, maloi lele. Welcome to episode 2 of season 2 of Relations of Salt and Stars. I'm Kehau Falau, your host for this season, and in today's episode, I'll be sharing some of the background of my project, a bit about my theoretical framework and methodology, and we'll wrap up with highlights from my first Tala Noa with Dr. Maile Arvin. To recap our last episode, I spoke a bit about the purpose of my research project and put out a shameless call for participants. My project, a Mada Moana Cosmopolitan Feminist RIP to D Academy, centers my positionality as a Panapin Tongan student and asks how decolonial spaces are created and sustained in the academy within the context of the U.S. empire. My use of Madao Moana comes from how my parents refer to our ocean. Madao is Panapan for ocean, beyond the reef and thought, and Moana is the Tongan word and a word used throughout Polynesia for ocean and deep blue. To share more context of the background of my project, I recognize that modernity is dying, and its promises of growth and prosperity have not only encountered the limits of the planet, but the various crises around the globe have revealed capitalist greed and colonialist dispossession. And so I question how we let modernity's darker side, coloniality, also die, while we care for the land, water, skies, the more than human, and each other. I argue the academy is a production site of coloniality, which is emphasized in Craig Wilder's book, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. He traces how the academy never stood apart from American slavery. Rather, it stood beside church and state as a third pillar of a civilization built on bondage. Dr. Sandy Grande extends Wilder's work to theorize the university as an arm of a settler state that perpetuates the logics of elimination, capital accumulation, and dispossession. Grande also speaks to hospicing the university, and so what my research aims to highlight is the influences of Oceanian feminist epistemologies and pedagogies in creating decolonial spaces within the academy that delink from colonial logics and work towards remembering and birthing pathways that reproduce larger kinship networks of relation meant to disrupt the erasure of Indigenous cultures and lifeways. In our last episode, I made a call to teachers and students of Oceanian feminisms to tala noa with me about their educational experiences and the influences of Oceanian feminisms on their work. And I definitely feel blessed to have engaged with so many generous, amazing folks. Before I highlight clips from my first Talanoa with Dr. Maile Arvin, I want to share a bit about my theoretical framework and methodology. My theoretical framing for this thesis is guided by Tavaism, a Tongan school of thought focusing on time-space and social connectivity, and Moana cosmopolitanism, a localized cosmopolitanism ancestrally rooted in the Moana and globally rooted through various mediums, including air travel and digital technologies, with underpinnings of cultural relational ethics. Epistemologically, Tava theory highlights how time and space are conceptualized differently across cultures and therefore arranges time and space respectively. My interpretation of this is Tavaism is a place-based theory that accesses temporal mindfulness of spatial arrangements. Another tenet of Tava theory says all things stand in eternal relation of exchange, giving rise to either order or conflict. I pair these tenets to another tenet of Tava theory, which is Hoa. Hoa is defined as pairs, partners, a binary dichotomy, and duality. I utilized Hoa to highlight how colonial logics govern our schooling system and how Oceanian feminisms collapse colonial arrangements of time and space and engage in new ways of relating. In Dr. Lana Lopez's dissertation, she coins Moana cosmopolitanism, which has offered me new ways in thinking about my own experiences in and beyond the academy. First, it has allowed me to shift away from deficiency and displacement narratives of diaspora and to allow for fluidity, complexities, and various possibilities of our own Moana subjectivities, including the lived experiences of Moana cosmopolitan faculty and their students. Within the context of the academy and stringent Western standards, Moana cosmopolitanism as an identity highlights the legacy of being ancestrally rooted in the Madame Moana, locally rooted in new places, and globally routed and rooted, both physically and digitally. This leads me to want to learn of their lived experiences, particularly within academia and the broader context of the crises of capitalist greed and colonialist dispossession. What I love about Moana cosmopolitanism is it also offers a lens to view relational ethics of local cosmopolitanism that governs spaces of difference, including ideological differences. A combination of Tavaism and Moana cosmopolitanism sets the stage for my research of exploring the influences of Oceanian feminisms within the academy and highlights the process described by Arcia Tecun of where the act of temporal mindfulness and spatial arrangement produces an alignment, balance, equilibrium, which potentially reveals harmony or makes disharmony visible, whatever the truth between energies and relationships are. They also allow me to highlight and focus on the underpinning ethics present in these moments of meditation. Oh, not meditation, mediation. But I guess both work. And so, for my research, I utilize Hohoko, a Tongan methodology of genealogy. Dr. Tevita Kaili has defined this as a research process that involves searching together through conversation for genealogical links, not only to get to know each other, but to identify family branches and linkages. In another co-authored article, Kaili talks about intellectual ancestors who created pathways by mentoring them through their educational journey, or by influencing their worldviews through scholarship and research. In recognizing the importance of our intellectual ancestors, I'm also interested in our scholarly genealogies. Therefore, My use of genealogy works outside the colonial logics of direct hetero-paternalistic biologized genealogies and instead points to an expansive kinship complex of people, land, ocean, and sky, and the responsibilities we have to take care of these networks. One of the research methods I'm using is Talanoa, a practice used throughout the Moana and Oceania region. Commonly translated to talk story or dialogue, Talanoa is often defined by two words, Tala, meaning to tell or to talk, and Noa, which has been defined as anything or nothing in particular, and balance, equilibrium, and zero. You know, I was very nervous during most, if not all, my Talanoa, and I questioned whether or not I was really doing Talanoa because I wasn't sure if I was Noa or Ngofua. This idea of balance was ever established. And so, if anything, I'm just really grateful for those who participated, for their generous answers, and their patience with me. I'm excited to share some of my highlights of my first Talanoa with Dr. Maile Arvin. To open my Talanoa, I started with a Tongan proverb and common question, Kohai Hohingoa. This phrase translates to who is your name, instead of the common English translation of what is your name. In this, I asked to include both their familial and scholarly genealogy. The next clip is Dr. Arvin's response to this question.
In Hawaiian, when you ask someone their name, it's Ovai Ko Inoa. So you can hear the resonances in our Polynesian languages there. In Hawaiian, I would say, if I was asked that question, right, I'd say No Maile Renee Arvin Ko Uinoa, No Kene Kuke Mai Ao. No Waimanalo, Ko'u Ohana, what else? Noho'au ma Uta, he Polopeka au, Makikula Nui o Uta, Mahalo Nui Loa. Hawaiians, probably like many other Indigenous peoples and other Polynesian peoples, have a very place a lot of importance on genealogies and kind of self introductions. And so, when you introduce yourself in Hawaiian, the first thing you say is like your full name. And I was taught that you have to say your middle name, even if you don't like your middle name or if you never use your middle name, you better say it. And then also like when you say, so I said, no kene kuke mayao, kene kuke is Kentucky. It's saying like, I'm from Kentucky, but like I was taught that, like, I probably wouldn't say I'm from Kentucky just if someone was asking me that in English, but that's where I was born. So in Hawaiian, it's important to say, like pretty literally where you were born when you're introducing yourself, right? And then the next thing I said was my family's from Waimanalo, which is a small town on the island of Oahu. And that's where my mom grew up. Her name's Wanda Leilani Arvin. Her maiden name was Owo. Her parents were, her dad's name was George Washington Owo, and her mom's name was Lillian Mahi Owo, or Lillian Kaehukai Mahi Owo. And I think you can hear in my grandfather's name, right, George Washington Owo, that my mom and her parents' generation grew up in Hawaii when Hawaii was a territory of the United States. And my grandfather, he wanted his kids to be able to
you know, succeed in kind of the new state of Hawaii after Hawaii became a state in 1959. And so my, even though he could speak some Hawaiian, he didn't speak Hawaiian to my mom and her siblings. And he didn't want his mom to speak to his kids in Hawaiian either, so that they would grow up speaking good English. And anyway, so that's my mom's side. My dad, his name was Tracy Arvin. He didn't have a middle name. He was born and grew up in Kentucky. My parents met in Waimanalo at the Bellows Air Force Base, where my mom worked in high school at the snack bar. And I'm told that she made him breakfast, and that's where they met. They met in Hawaii, but eventually she moved to Kentucky to be with him, and they got married in Kentucky. And so that's how I was born in Kentucky. What else? That's my family. My more scholarly genealogy. I went to a small liberal arts college for undergraduate, Swarthmore College. And I think it was, it's part of my genealogy in the sense that I think it provided me a really strong education, but also just opened a lot of critical avenues to me. Like it got me really interested in academic writing and scholarship and research. Even though I think almost none of my classes at Swarthmore actually addressed the Pacific or Hawaii. And so I majored in English literature there, but I think I couldn't really imagine going to grad school in English literature because, I mean, my classes there were on Shakespeare and Victorian literature. And I really loved all of that. I still think all of that can be really cool, especially when you're looking at issues of race and gender and sexuality and those things. But I couldn't really feel motivated to go to grad school in English to write more scholarship about Shakespeare or whatever. No shade on people who are doing that, but that wasn't really for me. And so I, after undergrad, I worked for 2 years about at a nonprofit in San Francisco. The Asian Pacific Islander Wellness Center. And they do HIV AIDS work for those populations. They do research and outreach and actual healthcare and things. I was a program assistant or a secretary type person for their research programs. And I really appreciated the work that they did. But I think I also, from that experience, just had a lot of questions about how Asians and Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders got grouped together, and why all the Pacific Islanders at our organization were in the lowest paying jobs. We were the secretaries and the receptionists and would be asked to perform or dance at events, but we're not part of the leadership of the organization. And so I think that experience really made me more curious about those things and led me to applying to ethnic studies graduate programs. I didn't know anything about graduate school at that time. Now I know that I should have asked a lot more people about the process and where I should have been applying. I just applied I wanted to stay in California, so I just applied to 3 programs in California. And yeah, I got into UC San Diego Ethnic Studies, and they had the best financial package. So that's where I ended up. And luckily for me, even though I did not know very much about any of this, there were already 2 Pacific Islander graduate students in that program. Madel, who's Palawan, and Maget Bavakwa, who's Chamorro. And it was really great to have them there and like be mentored by them. And then I was also, even though I think, I had made some of these connections before, but had never been in a space where there were kind of cross-Indigenous connections being made. And so there were also a lot of, well, maybe not a lot, but there was someone who became one of my good friends, Angie Morrill, who's Klamath Modoc, and she really recognized me as another Indigenous person and another Indigenous scholar. And I think it made all the difference that all of those people were there and helped introduce me to Indigenous studies as a field. And I think we helped each other kind of work through the ways that ethnic studies and Indigenous studies, are complementary fields, but also not the same. And sometimes ethnic studies hadn't done justice to kind of the particulars of Indigenous people's situations. So so I was at UC San Diego, and then I think especially through being friends with Angie Morrill, I got more interested in Indigenous feminisms. I think at some point, we started to go to conferences together. The Native American Indigenous Studies Association was formed, I think the same year that I started grad school in 2007. So I wasn't at that very first meeting in Oklahoma, but I was at a lot of the meetings that happened after while I was in grad school. And through those networks, kind of connected with other Indigenous studies or Indigenous feminist identified scholars like Eve Tuck and Audra Simpson and Mashana Goman. The context of kind of cross-Indigenous relationships look different in different sites across the world, but also across the continental U.S. And I think I was just really lucky to be at UC San Diego at a time where there were both other Pacific Islander grad students and Native American grad students who were interested in making those connections. And I know that that's not the case everywhere. But I think there's a lot of value in making those connections and those relationships. I think, some of the scholars that I felt most mentored by, in the beginning, were Native American feminist scholars. Slowly through, as I, continued to do my research and writing, then I met more other Pacific Islander scholars like Teresia Tewa, who was always just so welcoming and amazing, even to baby grad students like me, and Alice Tepunga Somerville, Michelle Arai. I don't think I would have been in spaces where I could meet them if I hadn't had that network of other grad students and then the pre-existing mentorship by Native American feminist scholars like Mashana Goman and Audra Simpson and those folks.
From the beginning, I love how Dr. Arvin highlighted the resonances between our languages, as well as the importance of genealogy and introductions. The shared protocol highlights the significance and power in our names and places. I also loved hearing the connections made and relationships had throughout Dr. Arvin's educational journey. It was actually Arvin Tuck and Morrell's article on decolonizing feminism that was a starting point for me to question academic participation in Indigenous dispossession. To hear how Dr. Morrell and Maile were friends in grad school is amazing to think about, as well as this existing network of Indigenous scholars. Another clip I want to highlight is when I asked Maile if there were any formable moments that shaped the type of educator she is now. There are a few moments of our Talanoa that I want to highlight, so let's begin with the first.
I've talked about the importance of like relationships and generosity from like scholars who were a little ahead of me. And I think my practice has been to try to repay, you know, kind of emulate that and pay it forward. I think that is I haven't talked about that part, this part yet, but I think that's also from like some bad experiences of, you know, I think in the academy, because it can be so kind of hostile to people of color, women of color, many other kinds of people who are not white, straight men. I think sometimes you like are expecting someone who might share some characteristics with you, you know, like other Pacific Islander scholars or other female scholars or feminist scholars, and kind of you might have an expectation about how they interact with people, but then it doesn't turn out that way because you know, some people they get invested in the hierarchies of the academy and, you know, and maybe this is a kind of trauma response, right? That when people have faced a lot of shit from their own experience, then their response is to like pass on that cruelty or violence to other people, maybe consciously or unconsciously, but it's kind of like, well, I went through this, so like you should go through this too, or you know, things like that. So I won't get too specific because our world is very small, but I think, you know, I think kind of witnessing that or experiencing things like that, I think like that's something that I talk about with my friends a lot, is like how did certain people get to be like that, where they like perpetuate a lot of the racism or sexism that people of color experience in the academy, even though they are themselves a person of color, right? And like, how could we make sure that we don't do that ourselves, like to other scholars of color? And yeah, I mean, I guess it's like an ongoing open question that I think we're always asking ourselves, like, I hope I'm not getting to be like that, you know, or like this happened to me, like, and I'm trying to figure out what to do. Like, how can I be sure that I'm not like passing on like the trauma of the academy to other people? So I think we all have like a very deep desire not to perpetuate like some of the violence that's inherent in the academy. And I don't think there's like, I think we all are trying not to do that, but are also aware that it's very possible that that we could pass that on, but we're trying really hard not to, and I think we're trying to help each other do that.
I'm not surprised at all that throughout my Liz response are refusals that are guided by ethics of care. The line of questioning and reflection of how not to pass on trauma of the Academy not only resists traditional norms of the Academy, including notions of rigor and academic standards, but also refuses to perpetuate the violence inherent in the Academy. I'm blessed to have my dissertation chair, Dr. Kaolani Vaughn, who is also so generous and who cares for me as a person. I find it no coincidence that Maile also served on Dr. Kehau's dissertation committee, and the continuation of these ethics of care being carried on to the next generation of students. I want to highlight another formidable moment that Dr. Arvind shared that also highlights the relationship between refusals and care.
I first encountered Haunani K. Trask's work as an undergraduate, maybe a little earlier, but when I really remember it, I've told you both this story before, but so I was an undergrad at Swarthmore, which is in a small town in Pennsylvania, and I had this one Asian American history class. And there was one week in that class on Hawaii, and I was like very excited, you know, it's like the one week of my college career that we're going to focus on Hawaii. One of the readings that was assigned was Haunani K. Trask, her essay, Lovely Hula Hands, which is, in her book From a Native Daughter. And so I was very, I've like read it and underlined it, and I was like very excited to come talk about like history of colonialism and tourism in Hawaii. And I came to class, and I am generally introverted, and especially as an undergrad, like I figured it out more as a grad student, but as an undergrad, I didn't really, I didn't like to talk in class. Like it took a lot for me to talk in class, but I was very excited and like ready to like try to talk in class about this book that meant a lot to me. And I came to class, and then the whole discussion like got overtaken by this one white male student who was just so offended by Haunani K. Trask's essay, and how so the essay ends by, you know, it's all about the history of tourism and colonialism in Hawaii and the negative impacts that tourism has had on Hawaiian culture, and that, and especially on Hawaiian women, who are come to be seen through these systems as, exotic, sexualized objects for white men. And so at the end of her essay, she says something like, if you really want to be an ally to Native Hawaiian people, like, don't come to Hawaii. Like, do not come here and, like, participate. Don't come on vacation here. Don't participate in the tourism industry, right? And this other student, he just made the whole class about that and about his right to go on vacation in Hawaii, because Hawaii is part of the United States, right? And, like, it's, like, nobody can tell anybody where they can't go, and, so on and so on. And I was just so, like, devastated. And, at that point, I didn't really have the language or the confidence to, like, counter that student. Now thinking about this now, I think, as a student, I was just really mad at the other student. But now I'm really mad at the teacher, because like, what was the teacher doing? Like, why did the teacher let this whole class get taken over by this one angry student? And speaking of formative experiences about how I think about being an educator, right? It's I promised myself that I would try never to let that happen to students in my classes, right? Where one kind of the loudest student who has like the most feelings about something, like gets to dominate the discussion. When there are other students in the class that clearly have like deep stakes in whatever we're talking about, and like the students with the stakes should feel just as comfortable like talking in the class as the students who might have a lot of opinions but actually don't have the same like stakes or genealogical ties to the peoples or the context that we're talking about.
I was also an undergrad when I first encountered Haunani K. Trask's work and was assigned to read the same chapter, Lovely Houlihan's. I think I would have been devastated too if my teacher allowed a student to monologue his hurt feelings. Something I absolutely loved about what Myla shared is when she said, "I promised myself that I would never let that happen to students in my classes." To me, this is so impactful because I can recall various times where either white or male fragility was at full display in a classroom, and me looking to one or the two other students of color thinking, "What is happening?" I remember during my undergraduate years, I wouldn't even bother to engage in hopes to save my energy. It wasn't until later when I gained the confidence and language to speak back, but even then, I think it was done clumsily, resulting in someone walking out of class or crying. And so, the refusal to let the fragility of privileged identities consume the classroom and instead to create an environment where marginalized students feel comfortable to talk informs me of how I'd like to lead a classroom. And so, as I reflect on my own goals of how I'd like to lead a class or how I'd like to mentor students, I want to end this episode with this last question. I asked Dr. Arvid to share her goals of taking part in the Academy as an Indigenous feminist.
The project that I'm really invested in right now is my research is on the history of reformatories and training schools, industrial schools in Hawaii. And I came to that project in part because my tutu, my grandmother, worked at a girls' school at a later period than what I'm studying, but that's how I came to know about it. And I'm really interested in how these schools functioned in ways that are similar to Native American boarding schools. Many of the schools that I'm studying were named in the federal report on Indian boarding schools that came out in 2022. I think this project, you know, my first book, I like my first book very much. And also this project, is just kind of more, it has to be more community engaged than my first book. Because, you know, my first book was in large part kind of looking at the intellectual history of race in Hawaii and in Polynesia. And so that involved a lot of like, you know, archival researcher looking at the writings of Europeans or Americans about race in the Pacific, which again, I think is important. But this project kind of necessitated me learning more about how to do community engaged research because for many reasons that I probably can't get into all here, but many of the institutions that I'm studying still exist in some form, like the former boys' school, kind of the ruins of some of the buildings are still standing. They're still very visible from the highway. But then the school that my grandmother worked at, that was the former girls' school. It's still today a juvenile detention facility. And so it has never like stopped being like a facility to incarcerate children since it opened in 1929. Anyway, and so, you know, there's just, and there's not been a very much scholarship, or I guess hardly any, like maybe there's one old dissertation about these places. But I think it's something that's really important to Hawaiian history that, that more people in Hawaii deserve to know about. And so that's necessitated me figuring out like, well, then how do I make this, or, you know, how do I share the research that I'm doing with people more immediately than like waiting years for a book to come out or, you know, things like that. And so I think that's, I don't know if this is what you're asking me, but I guess a goal with that project is to kind of learn how to like sincerely engage with community folks who have stakes in this history and work with them collaboratively to, you know, produce different kinds of outcomes besides, you know, I have to write an academic book for my job. And I like writing academic books and, you know, I think there's value in academic books and like, what are the kinds of outputs or other kinds of ways to get out information about this history, that community folks, who aren't in the academy, might find more useful. And so, yeah, through that process, we're trying to figure out like how to do like story maps and like build a website and like a digital archive. And Kenny's helping me with all of this, which is very wonderful. So yeah, I think that's one thing that I'm thinking about a lot these days and like how to, how to bridge some of the more academic parts of my job and really engage with a more like public community facing or collaborative kind of research work, which I'm still very much learning how to do. But I think one of the things that's intimidating perhaps sometimes about working with communities outside the academy is that it takes a long time to build relationships and to build like trust and authentic connections and things. And I think eventually I realized like, actually like things in academia take a long time. Like, and so like, it's fine that that takes a long time to like build those relationships with community. Right. And like, but I mean, I'm saying this all like after I got tenure too. So that reduces some of the academic pressure. But I think once I started to like, think like, well, like academic publishing takes a long time and community engaged work takes a long time. So like, how could I think about those things as like actually a positive thing that those take a long time and I could do them together. I guess that's one thing I think about. And then, yeah, I mean, another thing that I'm doing with both of you, right, is to think about how to build Pacific Island studies, you know, specifically at the University of Utah. But, you know, as we're, you know, Monday, I present our proposal for the Center for Pacifica Indigenous Knowledges to the university's Academic Senate and see if they approve it or not. And that's one of the last major hurdles before our center might be approved. And yeah, so I think another kind of goal related with that is kind of continuing from what we've been talking about today is like how not to be the only one, how not to be the only Pacific Islander scholar in the field or at this university. But I think one of the things I would like us to do with the center is to kind of build in more like professional development for other Pacific Islander scholars, which, you know, could look a lot of different ways, but just again, like trying to build some support networks for Pacific Islander scholars, especially if they're isolated and they're the only one at their institution, there are ways we could, you know, leverage even just like meeting, having things on Zoom and connecting over Zoom or whatever, and like demystifying like the academic tenure process or, you know, things like that. But like from a Pacific Islander perspective, which I think would be really nice for everybody to just to kind of extend some of the work we've been able to do together here in person, like to more and more people in our field nationally and maybe even internationally.
I wanted to end with these goals because they highlight the importance of community and family. For Maile to be led to her current research project because of her tutu, I think speaks to the mana of the women in our family and the influences of their teachings, not only on our scholarly work, but the work we care so deeply for. These ethics of care continue in her community-engaged work and work on campus. Something that has happened since our Talanoa is the Academic Senate has approved the Center for Pacifica Indigenous Knowledges. I've been on this campus since 2008, either as a student or a staff, and I'm grateful to have witnessed this growth before graduating. My eternal gratitude to Dr. Maile Arvin. Truly, thank you so much for all your support during this process. Thank you for your research, your scholarship, and your continued work in and beyond the Academy. For those listening, Galangin, Maloa Bitol, and thank you for listening. I hope you tune in next time.